here in just a moment. And then, as Nadia mentioned, we're going to have some space for questions at the end. So if there's anything that maybe I don't go into enough detail on, or maybe something that I didn't touch on, you will have an option to ask questions on that at the end. So I'll go ahead and get my screen shared here and we can get started. All right. Can I get a thumbs up, Miss Malik, if that looks okay? All right, perfect. Thank you. Okay, so bef just before we get started, I kind of want to make sure we're all starting off on the same baseline here. So we're going to cover a handful of topics today. We're going to cover some information on how financial aid is determined, how much a student is getting or what they're eligible for. We're going to go over how that's determined through the equations we use and that kind of stuff. We're also going to go over the different categories and types of financial aid and how you would apply for those. And then I added in some information at the end that I usually get a lot of questions on and that students find helpful when they're starting this college process. So first, what is financial aid, right? What exactly are we talking about here? So this can be any money from various sources that's coming to the student to help make a college a more accessible next step for them. So there's no sugarcoating it. College can be very expensive, especially it feels like it keeps going up every year. So utilizing financial aid and starting this process early can really help you get a foot ahead with when you're starting that college journey, making sure that it's affordable and accessible and something that's going to be a good next step for you. So financial aid can refer to that free money, like the scholarships and grants. It can refer to money that's earned through working, loan funding, all kinds of things can be encapsulated under this umbrella here. And basically speaking, financial aid is used to help supplement the amount of money that a family cannot contribute to cover the cost of college. So helps bring that financial barrier down so that it's a more accessible next step. So first, we're going to go over the different variables that go into determining a student's financial awards. We utilize some different equations in this process to determine exactly what a student is getting. So the first variable that we're going to look at here is called the cost of attendance. Now, the name is a little bit misleading. This isn't necessarily like the bill you're receiving. This isn't the dollar amount that you are paying for your student to go to school. Instead, the cost of attendance is the large encapsulation of all of the costs that a student might incur to go to school. That's going to include those direct costs like tuition and fees, maybe housing if your student is living on campus. And it also includes indirect costs. That's going to be things like books and supplies, right? Your students might need a laptop for college. They might need textbooks. They might need gas to drive to and from school. They're not necessarily going to get a bill for that from the school, but it is costs that they're going to have to pay to be successful in this, right? To be able to go to school and do what they need to do. So we do factor those costs into this cost of attendance in this equation to help make sure that students are getting enough aid to help cover those costs for them. The next variable that goes into this equation is called the Student Aid Index or the SAI. This is a number that's produced by the Federal Application for Student Aid, the FAFSA. So when a family completes the FAFSA, their information is plugged into this equation that's going to produce the SAI. This is a combination of the student's information, so it does look at student income and things like that, as well as the parent contribution if the student is dependent, so if their parents are on that FAFSA application. One thing I do want to mention here is this is sometimes a little bit tricky. The student aid index isn't the number that a family is paying for school. In previous years, this was called an expected family contribution or an EFC. This got a little bit confusing because then families were thinking this is the amount that we are expected to contribute, right? It kind of in the name there, but it's not necessarily that black and white. There are a lot of factors that go into this. So recently they changed the name of this to the Student Aid Index since it is more like an index number. It just helps us to determine what kind of aid a student might be eligible for, which eligibility bracket they're falling into, and things like that. So that's that student aid index and how we get that number. The reason I'm going over these variables is they plug into this equation that helps us determine financial need. So financial need is the number that we reference to see what kind of aid a student is going to be eligible for and how much of that aid they'd be eligible for. To get that number, we take the cost of attendance, so all of those costs that a student is incurring to go to school for the year, and we subtract the student aid index. So we subtract that index number coming from the FAFSA, and that provides us with the financial need information. Generally speaking, the lower a student's student aid index, the higher their financial need is. So the lower that SAI, the more grants and scholarships and gift aid and things like that your student might be eligible for. Just because your SAI might be a little higher doesn't mean that you're not eligible for aid or that you don't have financial need. It just might change the numbers a little bit. So that's the formula that we use to determine this information. Not all aid is based on financial need, and we'll get into that in just a moment, but this is kind of roughly the numbers we're talking about and where we get this information. All right, so now we're going to get into the different types of financial aid. So there are many different avenues to get financial aid for school. There are gift aid, like I have on our little pie chart here. So on the right side, we have scholarships and grant funding. It's gift aid because it's free money. So it's money that does not have to be repaid. This money is given to your student to help make school more affordable for them. When we're looking at scholarships, these can be need-based, so they can be based on that financial need calculation that we just looked at, but it can also be merit-based. So these can be awarded based on your student's talents, grades, athletics, maybe if they're going to school for that. It could be based on a number of things there. Grants, though, are usually need-based. So grant funding, whether it's federal grants, school grants, any of those are usually based on that financial need formula. Again, that free money does not have to be repaid, so we want to get as much of that as we can when we're going into the college process. But if you need anything in addition to that gift aid, that's where that self-help aid comes in on the left-hand side. So that's going to be things like student loans, so borrowed money that is repaid after the student finishes school to kind of help supplement that payment if you're not able to make that payment upfront. And there's also something called work study. So, an opportunity for a student to earn some money through working. That way, they can help to better pay their costs there as well. We're going to get into all of the different types of aid here, where to get them, how to apply for them. But first, I wanted to go over that kind of broad view of what different types we're talking about. All right. So as I said, there's a lot of different ways to get financial aid, and there's a lot of different sources that aid can be coming from. So we're going to get into each of these individually, but this is just kind of a snapshot to see what aid is out there and where some of that can be coming from. The largest and probably the one that you're most familiar with is going to be federal financial aid. So this is applied for by that FAFSA application each year. Just so you know, the application is not automatically renewed. So it is something that you will have to complete each year that your student is attending school to be eligible for any of that federal aid. So grants, loans, all that kind of stuff. This is the largest source of financial aid for students. This is where the majority of those programs come from. Again, these might be some of the ones that you're more familiar with yourselves. Generally speaking, federal aid is based on financial need. So most of the aid offered is going to be based off of that student aid index and that financial need calculation that we complete, but not all of it. And we'll get into that in just a moment. And then finally, for federal financial aid, there are certain eligibility requirements that need to be met in order to be receiving this aid or in order to apply for the application in the first place. We'll go over those eligibility requirements because we're going to go over more specifics on the FAFSA in just a couple minutes. So these are the most common federal programs that we would see coming from that FAFSA application. This isn't an exhaustive list, so there are more scholarships that are available through the federal government that are more program specific or maybe based on what the student is planning to do after school. But these are the biggest programs that you might see when you're going through this process. The top two are the main forms of grant funding that's coming from the FAFSA. So that's going to be the federal Pell Grant, which is one of the largest federal programs. This is specifically based on that student aid index or that SAI, and it is need-based. So not every student is going to be offered a Pell Grant. It is based on the income information, household size, all that kind of stuff. This grant can be pretty large. It can go up to $7,300. 95 or $7,395 specifically. This is also based on the federal budget each year. So this number can fluctuate. Traditionally, we see it rising. It has not increased for the last couple of years, but you never know. We can see some more changes as the Department of Education gets those budgets flushed out. But this is probably the largest program and one that you might be familiar with. The other main grant is the Federal Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, or FSEOG, because that's a mouthful. And this is one of the lesser grants. It's usually awarded at a lower amount, somewhere between maybe $1,000 and $4,000 annually. This is also need-based, so another one that is not going to be offered to every student. It is going to be based on that information from the FAFSA. And di schools have different budgets for this award. So it won't necessarily be the same at every school like the Pell Grant would. It can depend on the school's budget for that award. And so that might be something you might get FSEOG at one school, maybe not at another, right? So it is based on the school's information as well. The main work study program, so I talked a little bit about this, right? That your student can work to earn some additional money to pay for school expenses. The main program for this is going to be federal work study. So this is, it gets a little bit confusing, right? Because it looks like it would be a scholarship. You might see that your student is eligible for $3,000 in work study. This isn't necessarily money that is going to be given to your student up front to apply to that bill or anything like that, but instead it's money that the government has given to the school to use to pay their students with for that student employment. So to earn this money, your student would have to be working an on-campus job. Some schools offer off-campus opportunities to earn this as well. And then they can earn that money through their hours worked at school, usually by a paycheck. So it would come to them like a normal paycheck, like a traditional job would. They can also opt to have that money go toward their bill. So that can be a little bit more flexible. Again, that one is need-based. So not every student is going to be offered federal work study, but not every position requires it either. So even if your student isn't offered this specific award, it doesn't mean they can't work on campus at school. It kind of just depends on what's available at that school. For example, at Elmhurst, it's about 50-50. Some of the jobs require a federal work study and some of them don't. So it's up to your student to kind of look for those opportunities and if they're even available to work during school. Some programs are a little bit more intense than others and might not allow opportunities for that. So it's really up to your student and how comfortable they would feel taking that on if they wanted to do that. Finally, the last two we're going to talk about for those federal programs are the loan programs. So, first, there are the federal direct student loans. So, these are loans that are applied for through that FAFSA application. So, if you complete the FAFSA, you've automatically applied for these loans. There's two different loans. So, there's the subsidized direct loan and the unsubsidized direct loan. The unsubsidized loan is not need-based. So every student who is eligible to file the FAFSA will likely be offered the unsubsidized loan. The subsidized loan is need-based. So to get into the difference on those a little bit, they are basically the same except for one key difference. So they both have the same interest rate. They both have the same repayment terms. They're both deferred, meaning that you don't need to make payments toward them while your student is in school. The key difference, though, is that the subsidized direct loan does not accrue interest while your student is in school. Basically, the government is subsidizing the interest, so they're paying the interest on that loan. So it's interest-free while your student is in school, which, if you're familiar with loan funding, isn't very common. So that is a really great opportunity to get some extra funding for your student if they are offered that. But again, this is borrowed money, so it does need to be repaid traditionally after the student stops attending school. That doesn't mean you can't make payments toward it while the student is in school. That is still an option. It's just not required. Finally, the other main type that you will likely have access to is called a PLUS loan. So there are two types of this. There's graduate PLUS loans and parent PLUS loans. For incoming freshman students in college, we're mostly looking at those parent PLUS loans, of course. This is not applied for with the FAFSA. There is a separate application for this loan. So if it's something you're considering, just keep in mind you will have to complete an extra application for that. There is a credit check that's done as well. So that's something to keep in mind if you're considering this option. Not every parent would be approved for this loan, just depending on credit history, bankrupt history, things like that. And then again, this is borrowed money, so it does need to be repaid. With the Parent Plus loan, though, you can opt to start repaying the loan right away if you'd like to get in a plan for it, or you can defer the loan until after your student finishes school. So it's up to you on what would work best for you and your family. I know those loans have usually a lot of questions about them, so I'm expecting some of those toward the end. So again, if you have a question about that, jot it down and we can touch base on it in just a couple minutes. So after the federal programs, next the main source that we're looking at is state financial aid. Luckily, this is usually also applied for with the FAFSA application, so it cuts out some of the burden of doing multiple applications. For example, in the state of Illinois, we have the Illinois MAP grant. That is a state need-based grant that is offered through the FAFSA application, as well as the Illinois alternative application, which we'll talk about in a little bit as well. The main thing to consider about the state financial aid is that it is usually specifically for residents of that state. So, for example, if you are thinking about going to college in a different state, if you're looking maybe all over the country, you may not be eligible for state aid in that state. For example, in California, they have the Cal Grant. That's their state grant. You have to be a California resident to receive that. So, a student coming from out of state would not be offered that. But if you're looking at the state of Illinois, you could apply for that Illinois MAP grant to see if there's some additional funding that you can get that way. State aid can be merit-based and need-based, so it just kind of depends on what's out there. For example, with the state of Illinois, there is a nursing scholarship that is specifically for students studying nursing, either at the undergraduate or graduate level. That is more merit-based, right? Because it's based on their program, it's based on their studies, their academics, and things like that, not necessarily based on need. So it could go either way. The other thing to keep in mind about the state financial aid is there are deadlines to keep in mind. So you're going to hear the term first come, first serve a lot when we're talking about financial aid, and that's because we are restricted by budgets. With the state of Illinois, they set a specific dollar amount that they will pay out for this MAP grant. So if you submit your FAFSA application very late, you might have missed the boat on that MAP grant. So you always want to make sure that you're submitting those applications as early as you're able to, just to make sure that you're being considered for as much aid as possible. This is probably actually the biggest source of financial aid. I said federal aid was more because it's the most common, but odds are the bulk of the money that your student will be getting to help pay for school will come from the institution itself. So this is what we call institutional aid. This is money that's provided from the university to the student, usually either scholarships or grants, but schools may have loans and things like that that they can earn as well. And again, these can be merit-based or financial need-based. So they could be maybe your student is an artist or they're a musician. Maybe they can do some kind of audition to get some additional scholarship money for their school. That's something that Elmhurst offers, for example, that's pretty common. So they can be based specifically on your talents, your academics, your achievements, or they could be based on that FAFSA application as well. Generally, schools are going to use the FAFSA application to determine some information about this, but they'll also use information from your application to the university, as well as something like the Common App or those other larger, broad applications. So when you're completing that application for your institution that you're applying to, make sure that you get all that information correct. Some of those questions are asking to determine if you're eligible for certain scholarships. So you just want to make sure to take that seriously and make sure you're answering all those questions carefully to make sure that you're being considered for everything you're eligible for. Again, these are restricted by deadlines, so you'll want to make sure that you are completing these applications in a timely manner. Some schools provide additional aid for students who are early in the process. Sometimes it's called early action or something like that. So there may be a benefit to getting in early as well. So if you're considering a certain school, reach out to them, see kind of what their early window is and when they recommend getting that application in by so that you can be considered for the most opportunities. Finally, this is probably the most broad category here, but there are private sources of financial aid, of course. So, what I have on the screen here are just some of the big ones. So, different foundations, businesses, churches, your employer, maybe charitable organizations. All of these places can offer scholarship funding to your students. Miss Malik did let me know that there are some scholarship resources through your school as well, through your high school. So that can be something you can reach out about and see if there are any local scholarships that your counselors know about that they can help to connect you with. There's all kinds of opportunities out here. So this one is really the biggest thing to know about this one is to start early and cast a wide net with these private sources. You can kind of get one solid application going and just use that to apply to a bunch of different resources. These scholarships, they could be local, they could be national. So you could be in a little bit of a competition for some of these based on how many students are applying. So this is one that you'll want to submit as many applications as you can. Just putting out as many feelers as you can to see how much money you can get pulled back there. Every dollar counts when it comes to college funding. So the more that you can do, the better you're gonna set yourself up for the next steps there. Another private source of financial aid, it's not necessarily financial aid because it is your money, but there are things like college savings plans or 529 plans. These can also be used to pay for your students' expenses through school. So that's another one that I usually have a lot of questions about. So if that is relevant to you, again, jot that question down and we can chat about it at the end here. All right, so now that we've talked about the different types of aid, what's out there, how kind of what to know about it, we want to know how to estimate how much it's going to cost you, right? So on the school's websites, they might have some general information. It might not be very specific to you and your student situation. So they have these calculators that are out there to help you understand what's it roughly going to cost, what can we expect. This is a really good thing to start now since you may not have your applications into the school yet. You probably don't have any award letters yet. I know we're not producing any. So this is a good step to do early on just to collect some more information and see what next steps you might want to be taking. The government provides a net price calculator. So on our screen here, and again, we're going to share this presentation at the end and the recording. So don't feel like you have to jot that down right now. There is an aid estimator for the FAFSA that can help determine what types of aid you might be offered from the application. So again, that could be a good tool for right now because the FAFSA for next year isn't open just yet. So you might want to be itching to see what kind of information is out there. So this could be a good step to take now just to, again, collect some of that information. Most schools will also provide a net price calculator or some kind of scholarship estimator. So there are tools out there just to help you collect some more info now when we're kind of in those preliminary stages, just to better set yourself up for those next steps. All right, this is a big one. So a lot of times I'll get families saying, I'm not going to complete the FAFSA. I know we're not going to get anything. It's not worth it. I would encourage you to complete the application no matter what. You never know if you don't try, right? It takes about 20 minutes. It's free. I think it's worth it. There is no income cutoff to qualify for federal student aid. Remember, I mentioned some of those scholarships and grants are merit-based. Some of them, like the unsubsidized loan, are offered to every student. So there are aid types that you might be eligible for, even if you think you're not. There's also a lot of factors that are taken into account. So it's not just income. They look at your household size, so how many dependents you're supporting. They look at all heaps of stuff. I can't even get into the full equation. There's so many factors they take in, but it is a pretty broad application. So again, there's no penalty for completing it. It's not too time consuming, hopefully. So I do think it would be worth it just to get an application in. Another thing too is some schools again rely on that FAFSA to determine their scholarships, so they might not even be able to award anything until you have that application on file. A lot of schools like yours do require the FAFSA as a graduation requirement, so I definitely recommend getting it done. If anything, it's good practice in case you need to do it the next year. So absolutely go ahead and get those applications in again early if you're able to, just to make sure that you're considering all of your options. All right, so now we know what we're applying for. Now we know those scholarships and grants and loans and things like that that are out there. So we're going to talk about the different applications that are available. Obviously, the largest one is going to be that FAFSA, so that's what we're going to spend the most time on tonight. But I'm also going to touch on the alternative application, and we already talked a little bit about those institutional applications. I don't have a separate slide on those institutional applications, so again, just to confirm, those are going to be the applications that you are submitting directly to the school that you're hoping to attend, and it's going to help them to determine what kind of institutional aid you're eligible for. Before we get into the FAFSA, let's talk a little bit about that alternative application. So, if you're not familiar, this is an application that was created by the RISE Act in the state of Illinois that allows undocumented or non-citizen students who are disqualified from federal aid to apply for state aid. So, even if you are not eligible to apply for that FAFSA, there still is an opportunity to apply for some state financial aid to see if there's some additional grant or scholarship funding that you can get to help with your schooling. The alternative application mirrors the FAFSA application. So it looks for the same information. It opens at the same time. It's asking for, that tax income information, household size, all those kinds of things. This one for the upcoming 2025-2026 school year. So if you're looking to start school in fall of 2025, that application, both the alternative application and the federal application, open on December 1st of this year. So make sure you jot down that date, December 1st. It's a little bit earlier than it was last year, which we're very thankful for. The more time to get that application done, the better. So go ahead and mark that date down and make sure that you're getting in there as early as you're able to complete either this alternative application or the FAFSA. For the RISE Act or the alternative application, there are some eligibility requirements that you will need to meet, which I have listed on the screen here. Most of you, because you're attending an Illinois high school, you will meet these standards, but again, something to check in on just to be sure that this is something that is applicable for you. If you have questions about this too, you can always chat with, again, us at the end or your counselor. A lot of schools will have what's called an ISAC representative as well. I'm not sure if that's relevant for your school, but they are available for all Illinois students if you want some more resources on this. All right, so now we're getting into the juicy part. We're getting into that FAFSA application. So I mentioned earlier that there are some eligibility requirements that you need to meet for this, so we'll go over those now. The FAFSA does require that you are a U.S. citizen or an eligible non-citizen, which covers a couple of different statuses, the main one being permanent resident. So if you're a permanent resident but not a U.S. citizen, you can still apply for the FAFSA application. Some of the other pieces under that eligible non-citizen are things like any of the US territories. If you are a citizen of those, you could apply for the FAFSA. The other ones get a little bit more granular, so I won't get into all of them, but generally, they're looking for citizenship to be eligible for that FAFSA. You will also need to have completed or on track to complete your high school diploma to get that diploma from your high school program. You would have to have a valid social security number to apply for the application. That is specific to the student. So the student would have to have a social security number, not necessarily the parent, which we'll get into in the next slide or two. You would have to be enrolled in or accepted to a degree or certificate program. So, for example, if you're just going to take one class at a community college, but you're not enrolled in a program, you wouldn't be eligible to apply for the FAFSA. So, you do have to be enrolled in a program seeking some sort of degree or certificate. And then finally, you have to be enrolled at least half time, or plan to be, of course, for our seniors. So to get started with the whole FAFSA application, I always want to start with this because this is a step that you can take right now. Again, the application is not open just yet, but if you're like me, you might be getting a little bit antsy and want to do what you can now. So this is something you can get started on today if you want. Everyone who is working on the FAFSA, so the student, the parent, maybe the parent's spouse, if depending on certain tax criteria, will need an account with the federal application. So we call it an FSA ID, FSA being Federal Student Aid. So this is an account that you can create on studentaid.gov where you would complete the FAFSA application. And this will give you a login to the website and give you access to complete the application. The student has to have their own login and the parent has to have their own login. So make sure when you're completing it that the information on your account is specific to you. Something that comes up all the time is the student might have their parent's phone number or their parent's email on their account. That makes it very difficult to log in because you need to do that two-step authentication. You need to get the text sent to you and get the code. And if your parent is at work and you can't reach them, that makes it kind of difficult. So you'll want to make sure that the information on your account is your information. Again, this is used to complete the FAFSA every year. So you can complete this application or this account now. That way, when the application does open, you could just jump right in and start rather than having to create the account. You have to wait for it to get verified and it can just cause kind of a hassle. So again, if you're anything like me and you want to get done what you can right now, this would be a good first step. One other thing, I'm going to go back. One other thing I didn't mention about this is it mentions here on the screen what you'll need social security number. This screenshot's a little bit outdated. Again, for parents who are completing the application with their student, the parent is not required to have a social security number. They're not required to have citizenship. So there is an option to create an account and complete the FAFSA without a social security number if you are the parent. It is a little bit of an extra step. So they need to verify your identity. So they ask some additional questions to get that information, but you can still create an account and be able to complete the application either way. So as I mentioned, everybody who is contributing to the FAFSA, so they call them contributors this year. So it's anybody whose information is going to be on that application. So again, that's going to be the student, that's going to be the parent. If the parents are married, it'll be both parents. If the parents are not married, it would be the parent who is providing the most financial support to the student. If that parent has remarried, their tax information would be on there too. So anybody who is contributing their information to the FAFSA is going to need that account, as I mentioned, and is going to have a part in completing the application. One of the biggest questions I get is what kind of information do we need to get into this, right? This year, they have made it a little bit easier, meaning that most families can transfer their tax data in from the IRS. So you may not need to manually input your tax information into the FAFSA. Either way, I still recommend having that data with you. Sometimes you can't use the transfer for whatever reason. There's a handful of reasons why that could be. So you'll want to make sure that you have your tax data handy. The FAFSA always goes off of the tax data from 2 years back. The reason for that is not every people file extensions for their taxes and things like that. So they found that by going 2 years back, most students have their taxes done by that point. So, for example, for the upcoming 2025 school year, they're going to be looking at 2023's tax data. So, you're going to want to make sure that you double check which taxes they're looking at so that you have the correct version handy. You're also going to need your obviously demographic information, so your social, your address, all that kind of stuff. The student will need to put information about their high school and select the colleges they want to send this application to, as well as their tax data. The parents have a little bit less information to provide. They'd ask less questions for them. But again, taxes is the big thing they're looking at for parents. They also want to confirm marital status, family size, all that kind of stuff. So this is a good page to take a screenshot of or something just so that you have, excuse me, that information for what you'll need when you get started on that application. All right, so I mentioned that you can transfer your tax data in. So this slide goes over that a little bit more and how that works. The FAFSA uses what's called the Direct Data Exchange, or the DDX, you might hear it referred to. And this is a tool that connects the FAFSA to the IRS so that they can transfer your tax data over for you. This has made the application so much easier. The tax data is always the hardest part of the application. I barely knew how to read a tax return before I got started in this field. It's something that I would plug into TurboTax and they'd do it for me. So it was not something I was very familiar with. Those questions get pretty specific. So What is the number in Schedule 1, line 18? And it's, I don't know, right? There's so many pages in there. So this has made it so easy to get that information on the application for you. It really is a great tool. In order to do the FAFSA and be able to use this tool successfully, you have to consent to using the DDX. The reason for that is they are accessing your tax data, so they need your permission to do so. This is going to be asked of all of the contributors to the FAFSA. So it'll ask the student to consent to using the tool. It'll ask the parent to consent to using the tool. If the parents filed taxes separately, both parents will have to consent. So that is something to keep in mind. But this is a really great tool. It made the FAFSA significantly faster, too, which is very welcomed. All right, this question comes up quite a bit. So I do want to spend a little bit of time on this. When a student completes the FAFSA application, it's going to ask them these personal circumstance questions, is what they call them. And these questions are used to determine if a student is dependent or independent. This status is completely separate from any other dependency status. So a lot of times a parent will think, okay, well, I claim the student on my taxes, so they're dependent, right? Not necessarily. It goes off completely different factors than taxes do. So that's why they ask these questions to determine what your student's dependency status is. If the student answers no to all of the questions, they're considered to be dependent. So they do need to provide parent info to complete the FAFSA application. If they don't provide parent info, the FAFSA cannot be processed. If the student answers yes to any of the questions, they would be considered independent and would not be required to provide parent data. Some of these questions are things like, are you married? If yes, you're independent. If no, answer the next one. Do you provide or do you support any dependents or children? Do you have Army or veteran status? There are a whole heap of other ones, but those are some of the main ones. So again, if your student can answer yes to any of those questions, they are independent and do not need to provide student parent information. And if they answer no to all of those questions, they are dependent and parent information is required to complete the application. The reason I say this trips people up all the time is, and I thought the same thing. This is totally common. I used to think, okay, my parents aren't helping me pay for school. I'm taking this on my own. I lived on campus, so I didn't live with my parents. In my mind, I was independent. I was paying my own costs. I was, making my own way through school. But because I was under the age of 24 and couldn't answer yes to any of those questions, I was considered dependent for the FAFSA and did need to provide my parent info. So it's not necessarily as obvious as it would sound which status you are. So that's why they ask those questions to help you determine. If they do determine you're dependent, the FAFSA will have you invite your parent to complete their section. So they make it easy on you from that step. All right, so once you jump in there, you make your account, you complete the application, you get your congratulations, you've completed this. Now we go on to those next steps. So the student will get what's called a FAFSA submission summary or an FSS. This is sent to the student by email and it's also accessible on that student aid account. This summarizes the data that was on the FAFSA, and most importantly, this tells the student what their SAI is and what kind of aid they can expect to be offered. So this is really nice because you might submit your FAFSA application December 1 because you're going to be on top of it. And you might not have gotten your award letter from the school you applied to yet. In fact, you definitely wouldn't if you hadn't done the FAFSA yet. So this can help you to know what you might be receiving and start planning early, even well before you get that award letter from your school. So that FAFSA submission summary is very helpful to get your hands on. Then the college that you selected will receive a similar document. It's called an ICER or an Institutional Student Information Record. Essentially, the government takes all your answers from the FAFSA, plugs it into a nice little document for us, and the schools receive that, and we use that data to create your award package. Once we get that information, you may see that you're selected for a process called verification. So verification is a process that is most of the time random. The government will select random applications for the schools to verify the information on. It's kind of a way to just audit the data and make sure that the majority of them are accurate. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you did anything wrong. It just means that we need to check to make sure that the answers on your FAFSA are correct. Again, this is most of the time random, but there are some things that will be flagged for verification. There are some questions that are very commonly answered incorrectly. So schools might select you because they think maybe you answered the question wrong and it's hurting your eligibility for aid. So maybe you were selected and it's a good thing because they're helping you out to make sure that you're getting the aid you're eligible for. If this is the case, you will probably need to submit some extra documentation to your school. So once you apply to the school, once you start getting those emails and things from the school, make sure that you're watching out for those because they may need something from you. If they do request documentation, you will need to submit that before they can determine your award package. So it's something that you'll want to be timely with. Again, not every student is selected for verification. You may never be selected, and this information will be totally irrelevant to you. But just in case there are any of you that didn't want it to come as a surprise, so this could be something to expect once you submit that FAFSA application. All right, this is important. So, because the FAFSA looks at tax data from 2 years back, that information might not be accurate anymore. Let's say, because right now we're looking at 2022, right? I myself was in a very different position in 2022, so that could be the case for you as well. Maybe your parent lost their job. Maybe your parents separated or divorced and they're not contributing both income anymore. Maybe you have taken on another dependent. Maybe, your cousin moved in and your parents are now supporting them, so they have another person to think about, right? All of these fall under this special circumstances bubble. Luckily, schools are required to offer an appeal process for this. So, if you know that the data on your FAFSA is no longer accurate for any of these reasons or maybe another reason, you would want to contact the school directly to inquire about appealing the FAFSA. This would allow you to provide them with your new information. So, maybe you got a new job and you got a pay cut, so you can provide them with your updated income information. And the school can actually update your FAFSA to now reflect that current information. This is huge. So that way it's really important to do if you do think this is something that applies to you, because you may be eligible for aid and we just don't know it yet. So if you do think that this applies to you, definitely reach out to the school and see what that appeal process looks like and how you can get started on that. All right, that is all my FAFSA talk. So now we're going to talk again, just a couple of those little things that I get questions about a lot that I think would be helpful for you all to know. This screenshot here is of Elmhurst's award letter. We actually retired the paper letter after this year, so this one is a little bit outdated now, but the structures are all generally the same of how these are laid out. So I wanted to go over how to read this, how to interpret this, so that once you start getting those award letters, you kind of know what to look for. At the top, they're always going to list that sticker price or that cost before financial aid. This is not anywhere near the cost that you will actually be paying for school 9 times out of 10. It's just the price that is the overall charges that you can expect. Then they're going to list the aid that you've been offered. So usually they'll start with that free money, those scholarships and grants, and they'll total that up for you. And then they'll list the self-help aid. So that federal work study or loan funding, things like that, maybe that you may or may not want to use. So they include that in a separate section so that you can see, okay, if I do want to use that, then what would my price look like? And then all the way at the very bottom, you can see that estimated direct cost with loans there, that's going to be the net price or the out-of-pocket cost. So in this situation, this was just a fake simulation that I put together, but this student would owe about $11,000 for the year or about $5,500 per semester after their financial aid is applied. So that's just kind of roughly how the structure works. So the number at the top is almost always a little bit misleading because it is not including any of the financial aid you're receiving. One thing I do want to mention about this award letter too, though, is it is an estimate. So these numbers may change a little bit. The tuition price might be different depending on how many classes your student is taking. So this number may fluctuate a little bit. I would recommend, especially once you know, okay, I'm pretty sure I'm going to this school or I'm between these couple of schools, you can go directly to the school and ask them to put together an estimate for you of what your bill would look like, and they can get you a closer number. So this is a good reference just to see what kind of aid you're being offered, maybe which school is offering you more aid, but then you'll still want to take that extra step to go to the school to get that more exact number. So again, you can just start your planning. One of the biggest topics in financial aid right now, as I'm sure you all are aware, is student loans. So there's been a lot of talk about student loan forgiveness, those kind of programs out there. It's very much in the cultural talk right now. Lots of students are graduating with student debt, student loan debt. I myself did. I borrowed loans in college. Most of the people I know also borrowed loans in college. So it's something that I like to talk about. It's not scary. It's not anything that you should be fearful of or anything like that, but it is something that you want to be responsible about. This money, you do have to repay it at some point. So you want to make sure that just because you can borrow it doesn't necessarily mean you should. And I kind of want to go over some of that data here with you today. So generally speaking, this number is a little bit old. I think this number was from 2021 or 2022. But generally speaking, the average federal student loan debt for a student after graduating is about $37,000. Now, this is an average between undergraduate students and graduate students. So it's a little bit higher than just if you were going to a traditional four-year degree. But that is the average federal student debt that a student might have at this time. That same study showed that about 31% of students are borrowing federal loans. So that's those subsidized loans, unsubsidized loans, and those PLUS loans that we talked about. So 31%, it's not the majority, but it's a big chunk. I would say, depending on the type of school you're going to, that number can be much higher. Generally, private schools have higher amounts of loans that are being borrowed because the tuition tends to be a little bit higher at those schools. So it depends on where you're going, that number might shift a little bit. To minimize the strain of those financial loans and your repayment after school, again, you're going to want to be responsible when you're borrowing that and just making sure that you're borrowing only what you need to cover those educational costs or just borrowing enough to help make your payments lower so that you can make it happen, right? Some of the options of how to minimize that debt, how to be more responsible with that. First, considering what kind of costs are necessary for you. So, for example, if you're going to a school, let's say it's maybe 10 minutes away, do you need to live on campus or could you maybe commute for the first year or two? When you're living on campus, you have to pay for your dorm, you have to pay for your meal plan, there's usually extra fees, which might be fine. You could get that covered in your financial aid or it could be an expense that's maybe workable for you. But if not, that could be something that you can make some sacrifices for just to make it a little bit more affordable and minimize the amount of debt you are incurring there. Also, you'll want to prioritize the loans with those lower interest rates first. This is my favorite thing to talk about because it's a mistake I made in my undergrad. My parents, I was a first generation student, so my parents didn't go to college. We were kind of trying to figure it out together. So in my mind and in my parents' mind, borrowing one loan was best. It's better to have one loan than multiple loans. It makes more sense. So instead of borrowing the federal loans that I was offered from the FAFSA, I borrowed a private loan. That was a bad idea in hindsight. Those federal loans at the time had about a 4% interest rate. The loan that I borrowed had a 9% interest rate. So overall, I should have prioritized those loans with the lower interest rates first, because then that interest would have accrued much slower. Again, private loans, they're available. They're a good option for some people, but you're going to want to utilize those other loan types first if you can. Also, most schools are going to offer a payment plan. So maybe you can't pay that $3,000 bill upfront. I probably couldn't. That's quite a bit of money. But maybe over time, that's more doable. Our school, for example, offers a 5-month payment plan. Some might offer 10 months. So utilize those payment plans if you're able to, just to make that more affordable. That way, you don't have to pay that money back later on. Finally, my biggest piece of advice here is to just collect as much information as you can, ask your questions, and get your help. your school's financial aid office, so both your high school's counseling office and the financial aid office of the schools you're looking to apply to are there to help make this process easier for you and help you find those resources. So please utilize those resources to review all of your options, see what kind of advice they offer for managing your tuition payments, how to find scholarships, how to get that extra aid, all those things. We are here to help at the end of the day, and we want to make this affordable for you and help you take this next step. So please make sure you're utilizing those resources. And thank you all for your attention there. That is the end of my presentation here. So we can go ahead and open it up to any questions. There is a hand raise feature in Zoom, so you're welcome to use that. Also, you could just come off mute and ask a question. We're already utilizing the chat feature, so that would be a good way too. If maybe you don't want to come off mute, you can type a question in the chat. I'll be monitoring that here. So first off, Jen had asked, do students and parents create separate FAFSA accounts or use the same account? This is a great question. Every contributor will need their own account. So Jen, the parent would want to create an account for themselves with their information, and the student would want to create their own account with their own information. So everybody that is working on the FAFSA is going to want to create their own account. Thank you, Lisa, for your kind words. If you anybody else has a question, again, feel free to pop it in the chat, or you could just come off mute and we can talk together about it too.
I do have a quick question to
Yeah.
expand on the parents' FAFSA. So, if a parent already has a FAFSA because they're either currently in going back to for higher education or has
Yeah.
in the past couple of years, will we need to create a separate account for our student, or is there a way for us to add our student or students along to in our account that we have?
Yes, good question. So if you have an account already as the parent, maybe because you helped another child of yours with the FAFSA or did it for yourself, you can utilize that account to complete your student's FAFSA. Basically, what's going to happen is the student will start the application and then they will invite you to do your portion. So they'll send you an invite. And then when you accept that invite, it will have you log into your account and you can access their application through your account. So you would be able to utilize the same account that you already have. Of course, you would just want to make sure that you still have access to it. So you might want to try to log in, reset that password if you need to. But if you already have an existing FAFSA account, you would be able to utilize that. In fact, you would have to because your Social Security number is tied to it, and they wouldn't allow you to create a new account since your Social Security number is already in use. So yes, you would want to use that account. All right. I see Jen asked, how will 529 plans affect financial need? I'm really glad you brought this up. A really common misconception is on the FAFSA, they ask you what your assets are, including your investments or your savings and checking accounts and things like that. Your 529 plan for your student should not be listed in those, or excuse me, no, they should be listed in those assets. If you have 529 plans for multiple of your children, you would not want to include the money that's set aside for another child for your student's FAFSA application. So you will need to list that 529 plan as a part of your assets, but just for the student you're completing the application for. Again, if you have multiple children and they all have different accounts, you would not want to include the other children's accounts in that number. So they do look at assets as a part of the financial need calculation. So they'll factor it in along with the other pieces to kind of go through that whole equation there. So if your student does have a 529 plan, it will be listed on the FAFSA and it will be considered along with the rest of the information. Just make sure that you don't include any plans for any other children. All right, I'm going to keep going through the chat questions. We have a couple in here, but again, just stop me if you want to ask a question out loud as well. So Jennifer asks, when determining need, does FAFSA take into consideration if you have more than one kid attending college at the same time? This is a good question. This might be a little confusing because at one point the FAFSA did. Actually, last year's FAFSA, they did take into consideration if parents had multiple students attending college. Unfortunately, with the 24-25 FAFSA, they took that piece out of the application. So they do still consider your overall household size. So if you have multiple children, they will factor that into the application, but they don't look at if your student, if you have multiple students attending college anymore. Unfortunately, they did take that out of the application. I'm a little bit hopeful that they will add it back at some point because they didn't really provide very good reasoning for it. I don't think it's working as well as they hoped it would in this implementation of this FAFSA. So fingers crossed, but at this time they do not take that into consideration. That could be something that you can contact the school about and see if that's something you can submit a special circumstance appeal for, though. So that could be something you'll want to check in on, Jennifer. All right, Krista and Craig asked, do parents create one FAFSA if they file jointly, or does each parent still need a separate account? Yes, you guys are asking fantastic questions. This is great. If the parents file taxes jointly, the FAFSA is only going to need to access one tax record, so only one parent would need to make an account. If the parents filed separately, or maybe if your parents are not married but they live together and they file separately, in that case, both parents would need to have an account. But if the parents do file their taxes together, only one parent would need to make an account and access the application. All right. HJ said, should my son apply for a FAFSA before COD or after he applies? So I would say, generally speaking, as soon as the application opens, I would go ahead and jump in to complete it. So again, for this year, for that 25-26 FAFSA application, that's going to open on December 1st. If it's for future years, you'll want to take a look and see when that comes out as well. But generally speaking, the earlier the better. So as soon as it opens, I would recommend. All right. Jennifer, you're asking really good questions tonight. You said if a student has a custodial savings account, does that count as the parent or the student's asset? This is a good question. So, generally speaking, it's going to be whoever's name is on the account. So, whoever is the account holder, if the student maybe doesn't have access to that account because they're still a minor or something like that, it would be in the parent's name. So, generally speaking, it's just whoever is the main account holder, whoever has the main access to that account. James, yes, this is being recorded and it will be shared at the end. We'll also include the presentation in case you want to download that as well. Lisa, I completely agree. I wish they were taking multiple students in college into consideration. Again, my fingers are crossed, but I don't have a phone into the government, unfortunately. I wish I did. I have lots of recommendations, but maybe one day. Yes, HJ. Okay, so Ms. Malik mentioned this to me. So some students, it sounds like at Willowbrook, have the opportunity to graduate a semester early. So yes, if your student is finishing a semester early from school, they can apply for that FAFSA again right away. Some students would want to get started in college right then in that January spring semester. They could also wait until the next fall semester, just whenever they want to get started. But again, if you're not sure like exactly when they're going, I would go ahead and submit an application for this upcoming school year either way. Again, as soon as it opens, just so that you can get it on there. If he doesn't end up starting in January, it's okay. It'll just be disregarded. So I would go ahead and complete it. If your student is graduating this December, for example, that would actually be the 2024-2025 FAFSA application is the one they'd want to complete. So take a look at the FAFSA website and see which one. They'll tell you which application you need to complete. But if your student's looking to attend, yes, in January, perfect. So your student would want to complete that 2024-2025 application as well. Then they'd want to do the 25-26 application once it opens. Jennifer, you're reading my mind. We are on the same page here. When I was talking about 529s, I thought about that question as well. Do your retirement accounts count as an asset? No, they do not. So when you are completing those assets, click on those little question icons because that'll tell you more information about what they're looking for. Your 401k, 403b, those kind of retirement accounts will not be included in your investments. Additionally, if you, they ask about like your rental properties or your, what do they call it? I forgot the exact verbiage. I think like if you own property or something like that, that doesn't include your home. So you won't want to include the price of your home in that. That's only if you own like additional properties or things like that. So it'll be very important to look at those little question marks just to get some more information on what exact information they're looking for. Allison says, if a student turns 18 before FAFSA, does that mean the custodial account is counted for him? This might be a better question for your bank, I'm almost wondering. If your student turns 18 before the FAFSA, in that case, if that money is then shifted over to your student and it's then in your student's name, they have control of the account. In that case, I would say that money would be put under your student's information. But it kind of depends on, again, who has access to that. So each bank account works in a little bit of a different way. So you might want to double check with them just to make sure you're getting the terms correctly. But in that situation, it does sound like that would be counted as the student's assets. That's my best guess, at least. All right. HA asks, I would like to go in person to apply. So they do not have an in-person way to do the FAFSA. I guess technically you could work with your college to complete the application. So for example, at Elmhurst, we do FAFSA completion appointments. So we have students and their families come in person and we'll help them complete the application. A lot of times high schools will do that as well. So especially since your school requires the FAFSA completion for graduation, I'm sure they'll have some resources on doing that as well. So that could be an option for you. Most of the FAFSA applications will be completed electronically. So most of the time you'll be doing it online. They do offer a paper FAFSA though. So if you're not able to complete the application online for whatever reason, you do have the option to mail in the application. Just be aware that the processing takes quite a bit longer on those. So it's better to do the electronic application if you can, but they do have paper options if you would need it. Jennifer asked, are students able to take out loans without a parent? Yes, they are. So there are a couple different loan types that your student will have access to. The only loan that requires the parent is that Parent PLUS loan. So that loan is in the parent's name. The parent is applying for it, but every other loan would be in the student's name. So that would be the loans that are coming from the FAFSA. So those subsidized and unsubsidized loans, those will both be in your student's name and repayment will fall on them. Also, if you're utilizing private loan funding, that will almost always be in the student's name as well. Private lenders might ask for a co-signer, so you may be asked to co-sign a loan, but the loan would still be in your student's name primarily. All right, we're caught up in the chat. Feel free to keep posting. Okay, so October 1st, FAFSA opens. Does he apply that day? I wish it opened October 1st. It does open December 1st for this year. So yes, your student can complete it on December 1st. If you have other students who have been in college, October 1st is usually the opening date for the FAFSA. I'm hoping we get back to that date at some point. This will be the second year that it opens a little bit later. But eventually it will go back to October 1st. But for this year, it's going to be December 1. Right. I don't hear anybody coming on the mic. Again, feel free to jump on if you have any questions or utilize that chat. Otherwise, if we're coming to the end here, I could have Miss Malik jump in as
Yes.
well to kind of round us out. I'll stop
Yes.
sharing.
Just wanted to say thank you guys all so much. A special thank you to Megan for joining us tonight, leading us on this FAFSA workshop. A lot of good information. Really appreciate all of that. So I have recorded this presentation and we'll be posting it on our website as soon as we have that available. And if you have any other questions, we will have FAFSA completion workshops coming out later in the semester. We also do have an ISAC representative. So all that information will
Perfect.
be coming out to parents shortly. And then if you have any other additional questions or immediate questions, feel free to reach out to your child's counselor. All right. Thank you
All
all and
right.
have a good night.
Thank you all. Have a good one. Take care.
Bye.